All right, welcome back to Healing the Earth Radio here on CFRU. And I have with me a special guest host today, Aaron.
Hey, today we'll be talking with Derek Jensen, who is a writer who is increasingly recognized as a major new voice in cultural dissent. He has written books such as A Language Older Than Words, Welcome to the Machine, Walking on Water, Endgame, and Culture of Make-Believe. Culture of Make-Believe has been called a passionate and provocative meditation on the nexus of racism, genocide, environmental destruction, and corporate malfeasance, where civilization meets its discontents. We're really excited to have Derek with us today.
Yeah, so Derek, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Not too bad, I guess. I'm feeling pretty good. And maybe just to begin, we'll open it up wide, let you introduce yourself. And the first thing we were thinking of asking you was, if you can perhaps tell us a bit about the progression you've made in your major works with Language Older Than Words and Culture Make-Believe and now Endgame. And maybe tell us, you know, what you're trying to contribute to the community of resistance by writing Endgame.
That's a really good question. As I mentioned in an email to you, we should just sort of put this on the table so that if something happens, people will know what's going on, is that I've been having a flare-up of Crohn's disease for the past several months, and if I suddenly, in the middle of a sentence, have to run off to the bathroom or something, one of the things it does is it causes pretty bad diarrhea. And if I suddenly have to run off to the bathroom, then y'all can just chat for a second. I'll be right back.
No problem.
So I guess the progression for me of those books, and I should also, one more thing I should say is that Endgame isn't out yet. There's Endgame is coming out next spring through Seven Stories. It's going to be in two volumes. Anyway, the progression would be, in a lot of ways, language is, A Language Older Than Words is about how you make yourself sane in this insane culture. And then Cultural Make-Believe would be, once you see that once you do sort of make yourself sane and you look around, what do you see? And then Endgame would be, so what are you going to do about it? And the fundamental premise of Endgame, or I guess there's several premises, of course. One of them is that I would go all around the country and I would ask people, do you believe that this culture will undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? And nobody would ever say yes. And a lot of people would just laugh. It's a silly question. And the next question is, so if you don't believe that the culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living, what does that mean for your strategy and for your tactics? And the answer is we don't know. And one of the reasons we don't know is because we don't talk about it. And one of the reasons we don't talk about it is because we're all so busy pretending that we have hope and pretending there's going to be this magical transformation. So in the meantime, we'll just, do all this little stuff. But you know, frankly, the stakes are way, way too high for that. This culture, the dominant culture, is killing the planet. And then the question becomes, once again, what are you going to do about it?
Mm-hmm. I was wondering, I just want to throw a little quote from your book at you. When I bring up the faults in the government, capitalism, techno-industrial complex, or the culture as a whole, many people get extremely defensive, as if I just insulted their mother. And how do we as activists deal with this defensiveness in our communities? And in general, what do you think about that?
I think that there's two parts to that. One is that on one hand, a lot of people, I guess, do get really defensive. We can deal with that. And another, I mean, there's on the other hand, there's a lot of people recognize increasingly. I mean, it's hard to not recognize that this culture is killing the planet. I mean, take any sort of measure that you want. I mean, 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. There's six times more plastic in the oceans than there's phytoplankton. Phytoplankton populations are collapsing. And when you mess with a phytoplankton, it's really all over. I ask people, so how many of you have had someone you love die of cancer? And 70 to 80% of the people say yes. And I mean, cancer is a disease of civilization and caused in great measure by the toxification of the entire environment. I mean, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that, I mean, who's the idiot who first thought of putting poison on our own food, you know, in terms of pesticides? It's just crazy, crazy. And, oh, here's something else I just read the other day. This isn't in the book, but it just makes perfect sense that governments, of all the money spent in all the world, that's governments and individuals, of all the money spent, there's more spent on the military than there is on every other thing in the entire world combined, which means that, which means in this case, those in power are spending more to kill others than on everything else combined. Okay, and if you drop off the military, then, you know, if you just leave that money out of the picture, then the next big things that the money is spent on are by people and governments of the world are tobacco, drugs, and alcohol, which means that the second thing, and that's more than everything else in the world combined, which means that the first thing they're doing is killing others, and the second thing they're doing is killing themselves. And that's really, really messed up. And so my point is that there are increasingly suffusing public consciousness. I just read Margaret Atwood's Oryx and Crake. I finished it a couple days ago. And unless, okay, so anybody who's going to read that book in the very near future, shut your ears for a second because I'm going to have a spoiler. But unless I'm mistaken, unless I'm misunderstanding that book, it's in many ways a not unsympathetic portrayal of someone who wants to kill every human on the planet, the character Crake. And it's all because humans are killing the planet. And my point is that that's a national bestseller, it's an international bestseller, and it's suffusing. This knowledge that things are very, very, very wrong is suffusing. And I want to be clear that I'm not saying that we should, you know, kill every human on the planet. I'm not saying that at all. Those in power are doing that very well, thank you very much. What I'm saying is it's suffusing public consciousness enough to make that sort of book possible. And that's an extraordinary, extraordinary thing. Okay, having said that, there is this denial that we do bump into sometimes. And my response actually to the denial a lot of times is to simply talk to someone else, because there are so many people who, I mean, we have to, time is short and we have to choose our audience and audiences. And so if I talk to somebody who then says, you know, how can you possibly say that humans are killing the planet? It's like, you know, I'll give the quick speech on that. It's like, choose your, you know, at what point will you finally allow that? Will it be when the salmon are gone? Will it be when the passenger pigeons are gone? Will it be when the Eskimo curlews are gone? Will it be when, you know, every mother on the planet has dioxin in her breast milk? I mean, give me a threshold at which you'll finally say that. And if none of that works, then I recognize that I'm talking to someone who is a fundamentalist, and I'll just go talk to somebody else. I mean, I've been attacked a few times in my career. In fact, I just got a rejection letter from Sierra Club Books on my zoo book, because they said that book is a tirade, and the rejection is part of a writer's life, and that's all. It's fine that they rejected it, but it really bugged me that they called it a tirade, because first off, and this is part of the reason that the world's being killed, is that those who pretend that they are defending the planet so often are afraid of emotion. And I this came through my agent, so I didn't have any contact with the editor at all. But if I would have been in contact with him, I would have said the same sort of thing. It's like, wait a second, you know, at what point will you finally allow that someone can be outraged? I mean, if you go to a zoo and you see these, you know, grizzly bears who've been driven insane by incarceration, and you see all these other horrors that are perpetrated on these animals, then, you know, at what point are you actually going to speak out strongly? And the point here is that another thing they said is that we don't think this book is going to convince anybody. And basically, if presenting the facts in a strong fashion is not going to, the book's not a tirade, by the way, if presenting the facts in a strong manner is not going to convince somebody, then that person can't be convinced. And the whole thing I started with is that I don't write for fence sitters. I write for people who already recognize how messed up things are, and I want to give them courage and push them harder, as other writers have done for me. And actually, I need to run to the bathroom. So can we talk again in just a second?
Of course.
I'll stay on the phone. I won't stay on the phone, but the phone, I'm not going to hang up or anything.
Okay,
I'll be back in a second.
So this is a quote that was written in Endgame, but it's actually from Ward Churchill, an amazing activist. And he says, "What I want is for civilization to stop killing my people's children. If that can be accomplished peacefully, I will be glad. If signing a petition will get those in power to stop killing Indian children, I will put my name at the top of the list. If marching in a protest will do it, I'll walk as far as you want. If holding a candle will do it, I'll hold two. If singing protest songs will do it, I'll sing whatever songs you want me to sing. If living simply will do it, I will live extremely simply. If voting will do it, I'll vote. But all those things are allowed by those in power, and none of those things will ever stop those in power from killing Indian children. They never have, and they never will. Given that my people's children are being killed, you have no grounds to complain at whatever means I use to protect the lives of my people's children, and I will do whatever it takes."
Hello?
Hey, Derek.
Hey.
Perfect timing. We just read the quote from Ward Churchill.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I wonder if you can maybe talk a bit about that, and as well, perhaps, can you share with us your insights? This is two questions in one, but can you share with us your insights from your exploration of the similarities between abusers and personal relationships and abusers of the dominant culture at large, and share with us what this means in terms of our strategies and tactics?
Okay, sure. So you want me to not talk about the Churchill quote, or you want me to talk about that first?
There's a bit of crossover. If you could talk about that first, maybe, and work into the second one.
Okay. By the way, can you hear that in the background? That's my cat wants to be part of the interview.
Right on. Welcome.
By the way, also, Crohn's disease is a disease of civilization. I don't know if you know that, but nobody knows really what causes it, but it's very... Even if you set aside the people who don't, I mean, the increased ability of sort of high tech to detect Crohn's disease, even if you set that aside, as countries industrialize, the rate of Crohn's disease goes skyrockets. So it's clearly something having to do with either industrial, intoxication of the environment, or industrial diet, or something. So far as the Ward Churchill quote, that's, you know, I got into an argument not very long ago with someone when I said that the only measure by which we will be judged by those who come after is the health of the land base. And he got really offended and said, you know, no, and people are really going to care primarily about how we get there. And so, you know, we need to, and he was pretty much a pacifist and was saying, you know, we need to, you know, how we get to where we're going is more important than the place to which we end up. And I said, that's not true. What people are going to care about 30, 40, 50 years from now is whether they have food to eat and whether they have whether they have water to drink and whether their children are born with depleted uranium induced birth defects and you know, we can all move toward this really groovy eco-socialist utopia, and on a planet with runaway global warming, it's not going to matter. I mean, the people ask me, what do you want? I mean, that's a big part of our problem as members of, as not members, but as part of the resistance or part of the revolution or part of whatever we want to call it. A lot of us don't really know what we want. I mean, that's a problem with especially mainstream environmental organizations. It's like, what do you want? Do you want smaller clear cuts? You want fewer clear cuts? You want clear cuts that are only where you don't see them? You know, what do you want? You want to have your car and a planet that is only slightly, you know, less toxic than this culture's making it? And I'm actually really clear on what I want, and what I want is to live in a world that has more wild salmon every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that has more polar bears every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that has more migratory songbirds every year than the year before. And, you know, we can go through whatever you want. You know, it's like those are just representative. They're not just representative. They are themselves. And in addition, they're stand-ins. And they're not stand-ins because, once again, the salmon are the salmon. And I want to live in a world that has more wild salmon. And at the same time, I can't go through and list, you know, every single plant and animal and fungi that I care about. I want to live in a world with more wild nature every year than the year before, including wild humans. And I'll do whatever it takes to get there. That really is the only thing that matters. And I'll do whatever it takes to get there. And so once again, if holding candles and praying will do it, sure. But I don't believe that holding candles and praying is going to cut it. And so that's one thing. Oh, and another thing, before we go to the abuse stuff, there's something else I want to talk about from Endgame that I think is pretty fundamental. And in a language older than words, I looked at how the culture is really irredeemable from a personal perspective, that one of the fundamental theses of that book was that we have an entire culture that's suffering from what Judith Herman would call complex post-traumatic stress disorder. And PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, is something that happens if you are if you're traumatized severely once or a few times, you may get PTSD. So, and one of the things that will happen is that you become leery of those things that affected you, that hurt you so badly. So, for example, a woman who is raped in a certain make and model of car, afterwards, you know, if she sees that type of car, she may tighten up. Or I had a cat who died not very long ago, and maybe a month ago, and when she was a kitten, one time, I don't know if you ever do this, but sometimes, you know, I'll put my finger out and then the cat will come up and touch her nose to your finger. And one time she happened to do that, and I happened to have accidentally been shuffling my feet on the carpet, and so she got an electric shock. And so for probably 3 or 4 years after that, if I ever put my finger out at her, she would bat at my hand. And that's a pretty classic PTSD thing, you know, that I wasn't going to, or the great Mark Twain quote about how a cat who has sat on a hot stove will never sit on a hot stove again, but also never sit on a cold stove. So there's just so many examples. We all heard, you know, the Vietnam War vet who hears a car backfire and, you know, stiffens up and drops or something. And those are all PTSD. And then Judith Herman asked, what happens if you weren't traumatized once or twice or 5 or 10 times, but instead you were traumatized? Oh, and here's another example of the PTSD is that I could never, because of my father's behavior, because of smelling alcohol on my father's breath as he sexually assaulted me, I mean, I could even if I wanted to, I could never date someone who drinks. I mean, that's just that connection has been made, and I don't go there. Okay, so anyway, there's Judith Herman asked, what happens if someone's traumatized not once or twice or five or ten times, but instead, or one more example of PTSD actually is pretty interesting, is when I was in high school, I never used to swear or anything, and if someone would ask me if I wanted to go water skiing, I would say no thank you, but inside my head, I'm just cursing them out, and I'm furious, and I'm it's really, really weird. I want to deal with water skiing. And then I asked my mom, what's the deal? And she said that, and I'd forgotten about this entirely, she said when I was like 3 and 4 and 5, there were beatings associated with the family would go water skiing and somebody would inevitably end up getting beaten. And I had no conscious recollection of that. But once again, every time anybody asked me if I wanted to go water skiing, I would totally flip out. And, you know, once again, we've seen this in various, I mean, I'm sure I'm not the only person who's seen this in various relationships where you can do something entirely innocuous and the other person just flips out because, you know, you've touched some trigger that has nothing to do with the present day. Anyway, so Judith Herman defined this. What happens if you're not traumatized once or twice or three times or five times, but instead you're raised in captivity? You are a political prisoner, or you are a regular prisoner, or you are raised in domestic violence. And what she found is that not only do you get those specific triggers, but you come to believe that all relationships are based on power, based on hierarchy. You come to believe, not believe, but you come to experience that mutuality is not possible. Relationships end up scaring you very much. You could end up an extremely controlling person because if everything around you can hurt you, you need to keep everything under control. You need to control it because, my God, it could come after me. And so that's where she took it. And where I took it, and I want to say that she's not responsible for this part. She may actually disagree with it. I don't know. But I'm saying we have an entire culture that's based on an entire culture where we're all so traumatized that we have forgotten. We can't even conceptualize. We can't even experience what it is to be in a relationship. When I've talked to American Indians, Vine Deloria, Jeanette Armstrong, however many of them, when I say, what is the fundamental difference between Western and Indigenous ways of being, they all say the same thing, which is that the Indigenous people perceive listening to the natural world not as a metaphor, but as the way the world really works. And they perceive those others around them as beings to enter into relationships, not as objects to be exploited. So, you know, there's this tree over here. There's a great line by a Canadian lumberman. When I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And that's pretty much it, because if when I look at trees, I see dollar bills, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at trees, I see trees, I'll treat them differently. And if when I look at this particular tree that I see right now, I see this particular tree that I see right now, I'll treat it still differently. And it's the same. If when I look at salmon, I see a fisheries resource, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at salmon, I see salmon, I'll treat them differently. If when I see this particular salmon, I see this particular salmon, I'll treat it still differently. Or if when I look at women, I see orifices, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at women, I see women, I'll treat them differently. If when I look at this particular woman, I see this particular woman, I'll treat her differently still. And my point is that we have been so traumatized that we are quite often incapable of entering into all these just wonderful and beautiful relationships. And so we end up perceiving everyone around us, including other humans, as human resources, as resources. And that has really strong effects. We come to believe that all life is based on this hierarchy of power and that we are somehow at the top. And, or actually we're not. I mean, there are those above us who do violence to us, and then we do violence to those below us. And so that's all part of what happens when we're raised in this entire culture that's so traumatized that we can't enter into a relationship. That was language. Culture make-believe basically is takes that a step further, extends that outward. So it says that it looks at the problem on a sociological level, that basically if you have an entire culture that's based on competition, which of course it will be if we're all traumatized, if you have an entire culture that's based on competition, it's going to lead inevitably to atrocity and to hatred and to objectification. And so in the new book, and so that culture make-believe is how the entire culture is irredeemable as long as we have this system of social rewards. It's great. The anthropologist Ruth Benedict asked why is it that some cultures are really very peaceful and they treat women and children well and they are very synergistic and they're very people are generally really happy, and why in some other cultures are the cultures very warlike, and that's not to say that peaceful cultures can't have war, but it's an entirely different form of warfare. Anyway, this was really a lot more like play than anything else. And with these other cultures that have the really sort of nasty war and that have that treat women poorly and that treat children poorly and that have a lot of competition, what is it that separates them? Why is it that there is this there's this divide? And she said, is it race? No. Is it patrilineality or matrilineality? No. I always thought the patriarchy was root of all evil, but it's not. It's only like the root of half of all evil. Is it the wealth or poverty of the culture? No. Is the house size? No. And she finally came up with one really simple rule, that is, the cultures that are good, that treat the women well, children well, that aren't exploitative, those cultures recognize that humans are both selfish and altruistic, and they break down that dichotomy by making it so that the most selfish thing you can do is to do things that are good for your community. And they do that by their social rewards. And what you do is you praise people. We recognize that we're social creatures, and you praise people who do things that are good for the community, and you disallow behavior that benefits the individual at the expense of the whole. On the other hand, the cultures that are really nasty, those cultures consistently socially reward behavior that benefits the individual at the expense of the whole. And it all comes down to how culture handles wealth. That if in the cultures that are really good, it's handled through what's called a siphon system, whereby wealth is constantly siphoned from rich to poor, and that's done once again through praise. So if I go hunting, and I, you know, kill some animal, and then I bring it back, and I don't share among the, I never can pronounce this word, XHOSA of South Africa, among them. If someone didn't share down to the tiniest little scrap, everybody would laugh at them like a hyena, and they would make fun of them. In some of the tribes of the Northwest, they would have a shaming pole that you'd put outside somebody's house that says, this person's a jerk. Sometimes you'd get exiled if you don't share. And in the other cultures, you know, it's handled through a funnel system whereby wealth is constantly funneled from poor to rich, and it's a competition. And no wonder you all end up at each other's throats, because everybody's competing, as opposed to... And the reason, by the way, that if I go hunting, I could give it all away is because I know tomorrow that one of you is going to go gathering, and then you will share. Because right now, I could give away every penny I have, and who's going to pay my rent tomorrow? And this only works if there aren't any cheaters. And so that book was really about how this culture is really deeply based on this... On competition, and how that leads to these horrors, and how the end point of this culture is apocalypse. And then in Endgame, the way I take this whole, I approach this is I talk about how it's irredeemable on a straight physical level. And the way I deal with that is, you know, I've been bashing civilization for a long time, and finally with this book I decided I better define it. And the way I defined it is civilization is a way of life that's characterized by the growth of cities. And that's defensible both linguistically and historically. And that's all fine, Derek, but what's a city? And a city I've defined as a collection of people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources, which means that the people who lived, who have lived where I now live in what's called Northern California, the Talua, they were not civilized. They lived in camps. They lived in villages. They didn't import resources. They didn't require the importation of resources. They would do some, you know, trade, but that wasn't necessary. They ate salmon. They ate elk. They ate huckleberries. They ate clams. They ate sea lions. You know, they ate blackberries. They ate what the land gave them willingly, and they lived here at least 12,500 years. If you believe the myths of science, and if you believe the myths of their culture, they lived here since the beginning of time. And they did that without destroying the land base. And the dominant culture has been here for, about 160 years now. And of course, the place is just getting trashed, and because that's what this culture does. Anyway, so a couple things happen as soon as you require the importation of resources. One of them is that your way of life can never be sustainable, can never be sustainable, because as soon as you denude the landscape of that particular resource, I mean, if you require the importation of resources, it means you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource, and as your city grows, you'll have to denude an ever larger area. And the other thing it means is that your way of life must be based on violence, because if you require the importation of resources, then if the people in the next watershed over won't trade you for that particular resource, if you require it, you're going to take it. And which means we could all become junior bodhisattvas, and it wouldn't really matter, because the United States military would still have to be huge in order to gain access to our oil that just happens to be underneath other people's land. If you require the importation of that resource, or coffee, you know, it doesn't matter. Cocaine doesn't matter. You know, it's like if you require the importation of that resource, you're going to take it. And what this all boils down to is that any way of life that's based on the hyperex, any way of life that's based on the use of non-renewable resource. Well, I'm going to back up one more time and say, several years ago, I was in a riding a car with a friend of mine, George Draffer, with whom I've written a couple books, and I was just making conversation. I said, so George, if you could live at any level of technology you wanted, what would it be? And George was not in a very good mood that day, and he said, Derek, that's a really stupid question, because we can fantasize whatever we want, but the truth is there's only one level of technology that's sustainable, and that's the Stone Age. And we'll be there again someday, and the only question really is what's left of the world when we get there. And he's right, of course, that it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that any way of living that's based on the use of non-renewable resources won't last. So if every year, if your way of life is based on the use of oil, for example, then eventually you're going to run out. And it takes anybody but a rocket scientist to figure that out. And if your way of life is based on the use of steel, eventually you're going to run out. If your way of life is based on, you know, I mean, you can extend that one. And then I would take that a step further and say, if your way of life is based on the hyper-exploitation of renewable resources, your way of life cannot be sustainable. If every year there are fewer salmon returned than the year before, eventually they'll be gone. If every year there are fewer passenger pigeons returned than the year before. I mean, there were so many passenger pigeons when the dominant culture arrived here. There were flocks that darkened the sky for days at a time, and literally. And there were flocks that would number in the billions of birds, and they're all gone. They were killed for food. They're killed for money. And great ox. You know why there's no penguins in the Northern Hemisphere? The reason is because they were exterminated. The great auk. They were called penguins in Portuguese, which means the fat one. And an early French explorer said that they were on islands out in the Atlantic, and there were so many. They were originally in Europe, but of course they were eradicated earlier because the culture was there first. And an explorer said that there were so many on these islands that you could load every ship in France up to bursting, and it wouldn't make a dent on this one little island. Well, they did, and it did. And if every year there are fewer great auks, eventually there won't be any great auks. And I would take it a step further and say that any way of life based on, this goes back to what we were talking about a second ago, any way of life based on the use of resources is not sustainable. And what I mean by that is that, remember what I was saying, if you know, the Canadian lumberman, when you look at trees, you see dollar bills. And one more thing about this, and then I'll get off it, that I was doing an interview a few years ago in Spokane, Washington, and the interviewer asked me, you know, he said, you know, Indians exploited salmon too. And I said, no, they didn't. They ate them. He said, well, what's the difference? I said, well, they gave them respect for the spirit in exchange for the flesh. I knew the answer was kind of, you know, was okay as far as it went, but I knew it was also kind of nonsense. But I was, you know, I'm a male, so I was required by law to answer any question anybody asked. And that afternoon, I went out and I sat next to this tree that I had a long relationship with, and I asked the tree, what is the fundamental predator-prey relationship? And the tree gave me the answer immediately, which is, if you consume the flesh of another, you now take responsibility for the continuation of the other's community. And so if I consume the flesh of salmon from the Klamath River, I now take responsibility for the continuation of the Klamath River salmon community. And everybody knows this. I mean, mergansers know that if you eat all the frogs in a pond or eat all the newts in a pond, they're going to be gone. And so I've actually noticed this on a pond near my home, that the mergansers would only come through once every few years to take out to eat some of the newts, and then they know they've got to leave. And this year they were here, I think, 3 years ago, and then this year finally there's a big newt population again, and we'll see if they're back this year or next year. And this is, everybody understands this. It's just we forget it. I want to go one more direction here, which is, you know, there's this really stupid notion that natural selection is based on competition, which of course is what you'd expect from people who are traumatized to that belief. But I can disprove that very quickly, which is simply by saying that those creatures who survive in the long run survive in the long run, and you don't survive in the long run by hyper-exploiting your surroundings. You actually survive in the long run by making it so your habitat benefits by your presence. I mean, it's pretty obvious. And so one more thing about this, which is that I got in an argument a few years ago with this guy who said that because I use toilet paper, I am just as culpable for deforestation as the CEO of Weyerhaeuser. And it didn't make any sense to me. I thought about it for a long time, and finally I realized, well, I asked a tree about it for one thing, and the tree said, look, you're an animal, you consume things, get over it. And then also, it made clear to me that the reason I am culpable is not because I use toilet paper, but because I don't fulfill my end of the bargain. If I consume the flesh of a tree, I need to take responsibility for the continuation of that other community. So yes, I am culpable, not because I consume toilet paper, but because I don't stop Weyerhaeuser. That makes me culpable.